Hi there, you're listening to Stoiclex Explains. This is our channel dedicated to bringing you Junior Cycle and Leaving Cert notes in podcast form. For this podcast, we teamed up with Laura Daly, an expert teacher who's going to take you through everything you need to know about the poet Tracy K. Smith and her poems that are on the Leaving Cert English syllabus. So without further ado, the next voice you're going to hear is Laura's.
Hi there, welcome to this Stoiclex podcast on Tracy K. Smith. My name is Laura Daly. I'm an English teacher from Dublin, and I'm going to be taking you through an exam-focused podcast on Smith's poetry. There are 12 Smith poems on the course, which is a lot, so be sure to skip to the ones that your teacher has covered in class with you. Remember, you need to discuss four in depth and refer briefly to one or possibly two more for a H1. First of all, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Smith's background and her poetic influences, giving you a brief cultural context for her poetry. Then we will move towards the main section of the podcast, analysing each of the poems on the course with a view to condensing them into bite-sized elements to make them easy for you to remember. These elements will include looking at themes, imagery and sound techniques, stylistic features and tone. So let's begin with a very brief look at Smith's background and poetic influences. Tracy K. Smith was born in 1972, growing up in a devout Christian home and coming of age in the 1990s, when discussions around black consciousness created new linguistic spaces. She attended Harvard and studied English literature and African American studies. Ideas around slavery, racism, and restitution abound in Smith's work as a result of her education and cultural context. Smith's father worked on the Hubble Space Telescope project, inspiring Smith's poetry and her interest in the universe, and we see these images of space reoccur in her work also. She had a successful career as a published poet and academic and was nominated to the prestigious role of Poet Laureate of the United States in 2017, where she used her position to explore inequality and social issues in American life. While often political and exploring universal themes, her poetry is also deeply personal. We see the impact of her mother and father's deaths in her poems on the course. Let's move now to an overview of each of the poems. Have the poem open in front of you and pens at the ready. It's Not. It's Not is an elegy, a poem in quintains, which are five-line stanzas, where Smith contemplates her father's death. She explores the existential questions that so many of us have when a loved one passes away, mainly, what happens after death? She questions how we perceive people once they have passed and asserts we have a choice about how we envision death and the afterlife. For her, it is ultimately hopeful. The poem is deeply personal as the you addressed in the narrative is Smith's sister. The title runs into the opening line. It's not that death was thinking of you or me. Death was thinking what it owed him. This enjambment contributes to the feeling that this is an internal train of thought, which we also see with the use of rhetorical questions later in the poem. Smith personifies death and describes how death doesn't think of the family left behind, only of the dead person. Rather than her father paying his dues, death owes him his ride beyond the body, the garments. As personified death leads her father out of life, she describes some of the paraphernalia that is unique to each person's life, his tools and freezer, as well as evoking the idiosyncrasies of her father's nature, his penchant for watching biblical TV. Death let him pass the aisles of tools, the freezer lined with meat, the television saying over and over, seek and ye shall find. The biblical reference here lends to the cautious optimism of the poem. If we look for our loved ones, we can find evidence of them. This foreshadows the imagery later in the poem. Smith asks two probing rhetorical questions. So why do we insist he has vanished, that death ran off with our everything worth having? Describing her father as their everything worth having is a gorgeously emotive way of referring to a loved one, and here she is pushing back against a nihilistic view of death. She instead offers an alternative to this idea of someone we love simply vanishing. Why not that he, swimming only through this life, his slow, graceful crawl, shoulders rippling, legs slicing away at the waves, gliding further into what life itself denies? There is so much to unpack in this evocative metaphor. The image of the swimmer is impactful. It imagines the afterlife as a continuation of this life, only it also has a grace and ease to it, which is comforting to the bereaved. Is the thing that life denies us peace? Her father epitomizes someone learning how to be in a new realm, evoked in the double meaning of crawl, evoking both a baby crawling and a swimmer doing front crawl. There is also great strength in the image, with his strong shoulders and legs evoking an almost physical revitalization after death. Ultimately, Smith feels that her father is just out of sight, and the final simile of the poem is full of comfort. When I try, I see the white cloud of his hair in the distance like an eternity. It further propounds the idea that all we need do is try, and we can see an image of loved ones nearby. The soft alliteration of H adds to this tone of comfort. The final word of the poem, eternity, makes us think of life everlasting as opposed to death. So, to recap, have your pens ready. Themes: death, existential questions about the nature of death and the afterlife. Key images: personification of death, the paraphernalia of a life lived, the metaphor of the swimmer, the cloud of white hair. Stylistic features: enjambment, rhetorical questions, metaphor, simile, alliteration. Tone: questioning, comforting, hopeful, elegiac. Joy: while It's Not deals with the death of Smith's father, Joy is in memory of her mother and her final battle with terminal illness. After finishing college, Smith returned home to care for her mother as she died. The poem has three distinct time frames at play, and it helps with understanding the poem if you can identify these time frames. First, there is the present moment, stanzas 1, 5, 6, 8, and 9. Then there is her mother's past, a memory, explored in stanzas 2, 3, and 4. The future is imagined in stanza 7. And finally, stanza 10 is a standalone existential question about life and death. It is not necessary to outline this in a Leaving Certificate essay. This is purely for your own knowledge. The poem opens with a role reversal. Smith, the daughter, is caring for her mother, who, imagining yourself a girl again, asks her to prepare a simple meal of dumplings and kale. There is such an important theme evoked here in the opening lines, that of the carer in society. Who minds the sick, the old, the dying? In this case, it is the daughter, Smith. The language throughout is pared back, simple and straightforward. The simplicity of the language evokes the return to simplicity that this moment in the mother and daughter's lives has ignited. Even though it is a time of sadness and impending loss, some of the key verbs also signal this is a time of wondrous simplicity. Imagining, playing, trusting, listening, deciding. There's a beautiful poignancy to this poem. Smith recalls a memory of her mother's. The body is memory, she states. Her mother and sisters are playing hospital. They use raisins as medicine and have covered the mother with a quilt, though this is the south in the summer. Their childish game eerily foreshadows the mother's illness. Smith goes on to make two more definitive statements about the body. The body is appetite, and yet the body is cautious. The present tense gives both an immediacy and certainty to these statements. Because of her mother's illness, Smith is curious about the nature of the very thing that sustains us, our bodies. The mother has a hunger, but because of her illness, she must also be wary. In the seventh stanza, we are given a brief glimpse at the medical interventions that await the mother. Soon there will be a traffic of transparent tubes striking their compromise with the body. The idea of traffic contrasting with the slow pace they currently enjoy. The harsh alliterative T of these lines signalling the harshness of what lies ahead. The dark room of the mother's childhood where she played hospital is echoed in the final few stanzas when we return to the present and Smith observes, I know you are listening to a dark chamber around a cord of light. Here, synesthesia is evoked. The senses of sight and hearing are conflated. The dark and the shaft of light is reminiscent of anecdotal images of people approaching the afterlife. Smith posits that the body's a question. This line, so ambiguous, could mean so much and is followed by the rhetorical, what do you believe in? Who is the question directed at? The mother? The reader? Herself? It elicits thoughts of the afterlife, religion, spirituality, but offers no answers. Smith wrote herself how poetry was more about exploring questions than finding answers, and that is certainly the case in Joy. Now, for a quick recap. Themes: death, terminal illness, caring, the afterlife. Key images: simple meal, playing hospital, appetite and caution, the tubes, the dark chamber and the cord of light. Stylistic features: repetition of the body is, the final rhetorical question, harsh alliterative T, enjambment, simple paired back language. Tone, questioning, poignant, celebratory of our corporeal experiences, moments of dread. The Searchers. On the narrative level, Smith begins the poem The Searchers by using the film of the same title, The Searchers, as a springboard to critique ideas around gender, race, ethnicity, and colonialism. In the film, which is a Western, an uncle is searching for his niece, who was abducted by an Indian tribe. When he finds her several years later, she has assimilated and does not want to return with him. He is disgusted by this assimilation. More on this later. Smith goes on to use rhetorical questions to explore deep existential questions around the nature of living and why we try to control our lives. All of the imagery is tied to the imagery from the film. Horses and the frontier serve as key metaphors. The opening lines of the poem shock with the violence evoked by the imagery, but also the sinister sibilance. He wants to kill her for surviving, for the language she spits. The irony that he would want to kill her because she has survived as other is brutal. That the language of the Native Americans is debased by the word spits, a commentary on colonial oppression. But this is not just a commentary on race. There are also deep gender issues at play. The uncle reviles her femininity. The connotations of fertility and menstruation in the image, the way she runs, clutching her skirt as if life pools there, disgusts him. Her agency is completely shattered when he throws her over the horse and rides back into town. This opening image finishes with the first of three rhetorical questions. What does living do to any of us? As is always the case with Smith, this question contains a certain amount of ambiguity and requires some unpacking by the reader. There is no right way to interpret the question. Ultimately, I believe the question is reflective of the lack of control seen in the previous image, that living, being human, means that things happen beyond our control, and this is reflected in the other two rhetorical questions later in the poem. Why do we insist our lives are ours? There's a tone of disbelief here, that we fool ourselves that we have any level of control of the events in our lives. The use of we and us makes the language and therefore the imagery very inclusive and thought-provoking. A key metaphor in the poem is that of the out-of-control horse, tossing us aside like cheap toys. She pictures life as a horse past commanding, a beast that could wreck us easily. Yet the poem is not entirely pessimistic. There is a glimmer of hope for a homely future with a chimney and a rocker. The poem ends with the metaphor of the frontier, again an image associated with Western films. The frontier is personified and is imagined as a passive entity. Interestingly, land is usually gendered as feminine. Smith says the land didn't resist colonization, the transfer of power. The land wasn't really concerned with whether it belonged to him or to him. Either way, the land went on living, dying. Is this a message in response to the woman's power being taken away earlier in the poem? The final rhetorical question is ambiguous in tone. What else could it choose? In a society where so little agency is afforded to women and Indigenous peoples, do they just need to keep on living as best they can? The poem offers no definitive answers. So, to recap. Themes: colonialism, misogyny, the nature of living, ideas around control. Key images: the images of assimilation, the horse past commanding, the simile of cheap toys, the passive frontier. Stylistic features: three rhetorical questions about living, metaphor, personification, sibilance of the S. Tone: curious, slightly pessimistic, critical. The Museum of Obsolescence. The poem is an imagined dystopian future, where the speaker visits a museum containing all the things we value today on Earth, but which are now obsolete on this new planet. Material goods, money, religion, and states of being elicit both nostalgia and contempt. Concepts such as love and illness are foreign, and the old ways of our civilization are mocked and ridiculed. The final irony is that as the speaker leaves the museum after looking in a mirror, which almost accuses, there are still vendors outside selling t-shirts. A nod to the fact that our inane, harmful consumerism continues. The poem is a harsh commentary on climate change and our capitalist society. The opening image has biblical undertones. So much we once coveted, so much that would have saved us. Coveted is associated with sinning, and the tone is one of frustration at our ineptitude to do good with all that we had. This is emphasised with the repetition of so much. Smith excoriates humanity for our greed and consumerism, which appears to have caused an apocalypse on Earth. The museum shows how our material possessions have become obsolete, returning to uselessness with the mute acquiescence of shed skin. And the metaphor here of humanity as a snake, quietly casting off the accoutrements of capitalism, is impactful, the sibilance adding a sinister effect. In fact, all the items on display, green money, oil in drums, books recounting wars, evoke our failures as a species, our greed, environmental degradation at our hands, and our violence. The speaker in the poem is some form of evolved or altered human. There is the hint of the robotic. The harsh alliterative T and the onomatopoeia of ticking adds to the tension. Our faulty eyes, our telltale heat, hearts ticking through our shirts. This image seems even more relevant today than when the poem was written, tapping into our anxieties around artificial intelligence. Most disturbingly, in the museum, there is an old man on display, and he will be replaced by a video once he dies. Images of racist and colonial human zoos from the 19th and 20th centuries are evoked here. A living man sits on display, ask and he'll describe the old beliefs. This image unsettles, a human in a cage. The old beliefs signify forgotten or archaic values, and there is a sense that much has been lost. The poem becomes increasingly melancholy, the very essence of what makes us human. Our ability to love and illness and mortality seem to have been lost and are now observed as temporary art installations. Special installations come and go. Love was up for a season, followed by illness. Concepts difficult to grasp. As the speaker leaves the museum, the final ironic juxtaposition of the picture of a dead planet with the capitalist practices that helped kill it is extremely impactful. An image of an old planet taken from space, outside vendors hawk t-shirts 3 for $8. Without a doubt, this poem is a political one, a warning, but also strangely an acceptance that we probably won't change our ways. So, to recap, themes: excessive consumption, consumerism and wastefulness, climate change and our own willful ignorance, AI and robotics, the future of humankind, the essence of humanity, love and our mortality. Key images: the metaphor of the shed skin, the robotic images, the list of items that caused our destruction, the old man, the special installations, the image of the old planet, the vendors. Stylistic features: repetition, sibilance, irony, onomatopoeia. Tone: frustration, sadness, curiosity, loss, irony. Letter to a photojournalist going in. Letter to a Photojournalist Going In is written as an epistle, which is a poem or other literary work in the form of a letter, and this creates an intimate tone from the outset. The pronouns I and particularly you feature throughout the poem, as the speaker sends an intimate letter to their loved one, who is far away covering the devastation of a war. While Smith addresses big concepts in the poem, war, relationships and art, the poem never loses that intimacy because of its form. The poem opens abruptly. You go to the pain, city after city, borders where they peer into your eyes as if to erase you. The short sentences, the idea of war being pain, and the repetition of city adds to the harshness and the relentlessness of the imagery of a war zone. The photojournalist, a documenter of atrocities, is not welcome from the outset. The catalogue of destruction his cameras capture, bodies blown open like curtains, in the neighbourhoods, boys brandish plastic guns with TV bravado. This disturbing simile and the image of the boys mimicking the violence they observe culminates in a tone of horror, reinforced by the harsh alliterative B sound. The trauma of what is observed impacts the photojournalist, who plays it back in reverse at night. The poem shifts from imagery of the war, and the relationship with the speaker is introduced. The speaker is evaluating the relationship, and the use of two rhetorical questions provokes the reader to contemplate the nature of love when confronted by war and death. Up late, your voice fits my ear like a secret, but who can hear two things at once? The lovely intimate simile is followed by the idea that the lover cannot be in the horrors of war and express or experience love at the same time. There is a dissonance between the two states of being. Smith goes on to ask, How can one love in the face of such annihilation? Who can say the word love when everything, everything pushes back with the promise to grind itself to dust? The questions then move from their love to pondering the value of their respective jobs, their art, his photos and her poems. Ethical questions arise. Is there no dignity to what we do? None at all. Is it instead a vain attempt at a sort of immortality? This is an existential issue lots of artists grapple with. A way to kid ourselves into thinking we might last. There is a double meaning here. The "we might last" is also referencing the relationship. The speaker is unsure of the longevity of the relationship and fears trust is just another human trick that'll lick its lips and laugh as it backs away. The personification of trust as a sort of malevolent monster creates a threatening tone, the alliterative L adding a sinister musicality. As the poem progresses, we see a definite shift in language. The earlier violent language of the war has fully shifted now into the sensuous language of the relationship, and Smith conflates the importance of the photo, the flimsy frame, to the photojournalist, to the body of a woman, something to love in passing. Here she accuses, it seems there is an impermanence to his passion. The poem ends with uncertainty and a desire for destructive force. The speaker wants time to land at my feet like a grenade, a difficult image to unpack. She wants time at her feet. Does she want more time with the lover? Yet the simile is explosive. Does she want the relationship to end, as the way it is unsustainable? Smith's ambiguity, as always, pushes the reader's understanding to the limits, with lots of possibilities. So, to recap. Themes: pain and the destruction of war. Cyclical nature of violence, trauma, love, the meaning of work, art, mortality, the nature of relationships. Key images: bodies blown open, the boys with guns, similes, voice like a secret, trust like a monster, metaphor, time like a grenade. Stylistic features: rhetorical questions, alliteration, similes, repetition, language of violence, and the language of violence juxtaposed. Tone: dark, disturbing, questioning, deflated, exasperation. The universe as a primal scream. The universe as a primal scream is in many ways a quirky poem. The high-pitched primal screams of her neighbour's young children send the speaker off into imaginative flights of fancy, as well as triggering thoughts about death and the afterlife. As with the similarly titled The Universe as a House Party, Smith conflates the ordinary with the existential in the poem, using a grounding, everyday image to take us beyond the everyday. The language used at the opening of the poem is conversational and colloquial, adding to the comedic scene created by the imagery of the children screaming. 5 p.m. on the nose, they open their mouths and it rolls out, high, shrill and metallic. The idiom, the present tense verbs and the time reference all root us immediately in the noise, the interruption. The repeated O sounds mirror the open mouths and the synesthesia of the scream being described as metallic shows Smith's mastery and skill. Playfully, the speaker wonders if the coordinated screaming is an experiment to shatter the good crystal. She imagines the mother, still proud of the 4 pink lungs she nursed to such might. Stanza 2 shifts from the real to the fantasy. The speaker imagines the screams prompt the buildings to lift off and they will all ride to glory like Elijah, a biblical reference to a prophet who was lifted off to heaven. At this point, the language shifts towards a more biblical register. Let the sky pass from blue to red to molten gold to black. Let the heaven we inherit approach. We see the anaphora of the "let the" and the reference to heaven shift the focus. The array of colours lends a wonderful vividness to the image. The colours with their many meanings force us to question what type of heaven this is. The third stanza explores how heaven may be. Smith imagines multiple alternatives, a roiling infinity of space, or will we be welcomed like a father, or will it be a furnace? She asserts the whatever it is, she is ready to meet what refuses to let us keep anything for long. She is ready to meet the creator of our mortality and temporality. One of the most impactful images of the poem follows. What teases us with blessings, bends us with grief? Wizard, thief, the great wind rushing to knock our mirrors to the floor, to sweep our short lives clean. I mean, Smith uses multiple metaphors to describe a godlike being, none particularly flattering. This god teases and breaks us and sweeps away our lives. The internal rhyme, grief, thief, clean, mean, adds a pace and musicality to the image. The final stanza reverts to the conversational language and tone of the first. Her flights of fancy and existential musings are grounded again by the noises of the everyday, the racket of the stereo on shuffle, the neighbour chopping onions. We return to the primal screams of the children in the title, and the two themes cohere in the final image, screaming like the dawn of man, as if something they have no name for has begun to insist upon being born. This godlike force that perpetuates humanity lives in these children's voices. So, to recap, themes: the ordinary and the afterlife, the potential malevolence of God. Key images: the screams of the children, the building lifting off, heaven, the metaphors of God, the sounds of the everyday. Stylistic features: the use of the present tense, anaphora, colours, synesthesia. Tone: conversational, playful, curious, cautious, defiant. The Universe is a House Party. The Universe is a House Party is such a fantastically fun title for a poem. But as with all of Smith's poetry, there is a serious message under the light-hearted imagery. Smith compares the universe to a house party in terms of the chaos of the aftermath of it. She imagines people on Earth not being invited to the house party, meaning so much of space is unknowable. The poem goes on to describe how humans make telescopes, lenses of impossible strength, in our efforts to contact beings from space, and how we imagine we will welcome them to our planet. However, the conclusion of the poem is entirely ironic, because as we welcome them, they understand our insincere and territorial nature. As it turns out, not everyone is invited to the party. The poem opens with, "The universe is expanding. Look, postcards and panties, bottles with lipstick on the rim." The matter-of-fact scientific statement is playfully juxtaposed with the frivolous paraphernalia of the aftermath of a house party. Those objects signify consumption, but also there is an undercurrent of sexuality here. However, these objects are whisked into file, drifting to the edge of what doesn't end, like the air inside a balloon. The simile is comparing something limitless to the expansion of a balloon, and the idea of things being forgotten and discarded is evoked in this image of space. Smith once again highlights humanity's consumerist and wasteful nature, as she does in other poems. A series of rhetorical questions follow, which evokes the speaker's awe and our ignorance as to the reality of the wider universe. Is it bright? A conflagration of suns? The imagery returns to the extended metaphor of the party, becoming more auditory and utilising onomatopoeia to bring the party to life. Bass throbbing through walls and everyone thudding around drunk on the roof. The crux of the poem lies in the final stanzas, where Smith elucidates one of the central problems of American society: racism and anti-immigrant sentiment. She posits that we believe that we would welcome aliens with pinprick mouths and nubbin limbs, but that human nature would instantly reveal itself to any new beings we would encounter. Dream of beings we'll welcome with indefatigable hospitality. How marvellous you've come. The image is a nod to the American dream that fuels immigration, and the direct speech evokes the irony that increasingly immigration has become a contentious issue fraught with racism. This is also captured in the use of the Spanish phrase, mi casa es su casa, highlighting that a lot of immigrants are of Hispanic origin, yet are treated poorly in the US. The image, seeing us, they'll know exactly what we mean, is eviscerating. My house is your house conjures humanity's colonial and expansionist history. The final line then stands alone, and the repetition of ours highlights this theme of the territorial nature of human society. Of course, it's ours. If it's anyone's, it's ours. So, to recap. Themes: the unknowable secrets of the universe, humanity's relationship to the earth, our culture of wastefulness, introspection on American and Western society and its attitude towards colonialism, expansionism and immigration. Key images: the paraphernalia of a house party, the balloon, the aliens. Stylistic features: the extended metaphor comparing a house party to the universe, the direct speech, the Spanish, repetition, onomatopoeia, rhetorical questions. Tone, wonder, curiosity, critical, ironic, reflective. Dominion over Beasts of the Earth. The poem Dominion over Beasts of the Earth is a catalogue of the speaker's ex-boyfriends and ex-lovers. The title and epigraph refer to Adam naming the beasts in the Bible and having power over them. Paradoxically, and for reasons unknown to the reader, she names all the men Mauricio. The poem is a nostalgic or dreamlike remembering. Any references to power relations within the relationships are subtle. There are four Mauricios mentioned in the poem, but this is also open to interpretation. There is ambiguity at times as to whether someone new is being addressed or not. The first stanza deals with the appearance of the first Mauricio in a dream. Last night it was Mauricio again. At the hacienda they say he and Veronica bought together. In the dream they are cavorting around a house he now owns with someone else. There is an energy and vibrancy to the language in this stanza. Ran, giddy, dance, breath, charging, moving. These words capture two young people at play, but also with a burgeoning sexual chemistry. The simile, giddy as kid goats, perfectly evoking this youthful playfulness. The stanza is filled with contrasts, dark rooms and the prescience of light, heavy, heavy, and weightlessness. These dichotomies perfectly capture the inconsistencies of a dream and add to the dreamlike quality of the stanza. We wonder at the final image of the two moving with the prescience of light. Prescience means having an insight before something happens. And there is a lovely ambiguity to this image that we also encounter later in the poem. Smith always leaves certain aspects open to interpretation. The second Mauricio, whom we encounter in the second stanza, is a much more masculine presence. Enormous Mauricio, with the drunken legs and the hands as large as white magnolias. The direct speech that opens the stanza, has lo que te da la puta gana, meaning do whatever the hell you want, is ambiguous. Is it his voice? Is it hers? Is the tone one of throwing caution to the wind? Or is it tinged with annoyance? What is clear is the speaker did not sleep with this Mauricio, and now she wonders, what would have really happened if we'd done it that night in your neighbourhood at the end of the world? The sexual language and intimate imagery continue here with the words splayed, mattress, curled and cradling. The rhetorical questions the speaker asks, lending a tone of nostalgia to this unconsummated relationship. This tone changes quite sharply at the beginning of the third stanza. She wants to speak to the ones I've said meant nothing. She addresses a young boy of 13, a boy on the cusp. She wishes herself someone else. The insecurities of adolescence reveal themselves in this stanza. Perhaps the ones she said meant nothing actually did. The key to this stanza is the final rhetorical question. Tell me, Mauricio, at that age, what does a boy carry with him? She knows the insecurities a girl carries with her. She's outlined them in the desire to be Kathy. But now, as an adult, she questions what hopes, dreams and insecurities a boy at that age might also carry. The fourth stanza could be the same Mauricio, but years later, who has become a teacher. She compares him to a spool that would not stay wound, and the metaphor hints at an unravelling, either of him or of their relationship. We learn the speaker burned our letters. The final stanza deals with a more serious relationship, a marriage, a failing one. She remembers an instance when this Mauricio, whom she says she almost wants to speak to, stood up to fight once in a crowded room, insisting I was his wife. There is embarrassment here at this macho showmanship. The speaker wants to laugh and reject this claim of ownership, but then realises the ring that married me to the right person, two sizes too loose, was still on my finger. She recalls an unhappy marriage. The ring doesn't fit, the mournful assonance attesting to this final mood of regret and chagrin. So, to recap. Themes. Past relationships. Sexual chemistry. Failed relationships. Key images. The dream. The enormous Mauricio. The young Mauricio. The burned letters. The husband standing up to fight and claim her. The loose wedding ring. Stylistic features. Repetition. Mauricio the name as a pseudonym for her lovers. Similes. Rhetorical questions. Tone. Nostalgia. Dreamlike. Regretful. Ghazal. Ghazal is a form of poetry, like a sonnet or a sestina. A ghazal is originally an Arabic form, which traditionally would have dealt with loss and romantic love. It is written in couplets, and the last word or phrase from each couplet rhymes or is repeated. You do not need to put this detail into your Leaving Cert essay. This is just for your information. However, it is important to note the repeated phrase in this poem is our name, which has a deeply powerful resonance when the poem's themes of slavery and racism are examined. The poem's couplets are full of vivid imagery, and each image holds immense power. Yet there is no unifying narrative thread, so we will choose the most impactful of these images to analyse for your essay. The poem is a powerful reckoning with America's history of slavery and the resulting endemic racism in that society. This is a theme often explored by Smith in poetry, as we have seen. The imagery in the poem echoes the images of slavery that are etched in history. The cotton fields in stanza 1, the slave ships in stanza 2, the imagery of trees evoking lynchings in stanza 5, voices being silenced and then reclaiming power in stanzas 3, 6 and 7. The opening image is arresting, the tone confronting. The sky is a dry, pitiless white, the pitiless white evoking the slave owners from the outset. The wide rows are the cotton fields that meant death for so many. The speaker themselves is picking cotton, using a powerful simile to depict her hands like famished birds. They strip each stalk of its stolen crop, our name. The threatening sibilance in this line adds to the sinister effect, strip and stolen being particularly evocative. This concept of naming and the importance and value in a name is something also addressed in the next poem we'll look at, from I Will Tell You the Truth About This, I Will Tell You All About It. A slave was traditionally given the surname of their owner, as opposed to their family name. So this process of reclaiming our name, and therefore their ancestry, is extremely powerful. The metaphor of history as a ship forever setting sail is powerful. Not only does it evoke images of the slave ships, but there is a sense that history is not something confined to the past, that it is part of the present, highlighted using the present tense is. The lens through which we view history evolves. The metaphor of the oceans of bone is disturbing and jarring, calling to mind all those who never completed the journey, the mournful assonance adding to the pathos here. Language and sounds form an important part of the imagery in the poem. Smith imagines what will sound from us when the oppressed achieve what they have sought. She wonders if what we seek lives outside of speech. And finally, she conjures the sound rising from a moan to growl, growl to a hound's low bray. All this onomatopoeic imagery suggests the experience of slavery is so damaging that language can't capture the trauma. Only primal sounds can evoke the pain and reclamation. The final stanza is not entirely hopeful for redemption. Will it thunder up, the call of time, or lie quiet as a bedrock beneath our feet? Our name, our name, our name, our fraught, fraught name. Smith wonders if the fraught name of slaves and their descendants will have the power to call our society to a reckoning, or if the racism they endured will be the very foundations upon which we continue to build our society and oppress people of colour. It is a deeply political question, and the repetition of fraught offers little hope. So, to recap. Themes: historical retribution, slavery, the inadequacy of language in evoking the trauma of slavery, the importance of naming. Key images: the rows of cotton, the slave ships, the tree, the references to sound. Stylistic features: simile, metaphor, sibilance, assonance, onomatopoeia, repetition, rhetorical questions. Tone: angry, empowered, disturbing, pessimistic. From I Will Tell You the Truth About This, I Will Tell You All About It. This poem is a poem in fragments. It is a series of excerpts from historical records. The lines are the voices of Black Civil War veterans claiming their right to an army pension, seemingly with little success. There is purposely no other voice in the poem, no unifying speaker. The men were so long denied a voice due to slavery and endemic racism, they finally have a chance to have their voices and their petitions heard through the poem. There are four distinct threads of narratives running through the poem. The first section is when all the soldiers are giving their age, or in some cases, approximations. I am 60-odd years of age. There is a lack of legitimacy under the law with the absence of an exact age, the absence of a birth certificate. We also notice from the outset of the poem that each voice is interrupted with a dash. It interrupts every voice until the final stanza. This has the effect of showing these voices have been continually interrupted and it is purposefully jarring to the reader. The claimants then outline the health issues they have endured while awaiting the payment of their pensions. These issues include disease of the eyes, varicose vein, and rheumatism. But their petitions have been largely ignored. I filed my claim, I think, first about 12 years ago. And the reader empathises with the pattern of injustice that is emerging from this chorus of voices. The next part details the youth and anxiety of the young men when they first join the army. The image of some chin whiskers and a green boy right off the farm are the few visual images that we have in the poem. This section creates the only cohesive anecdote in the poem, about a soldier whose commanding officer exploited his illiteracy and possibly stole his bounty, his signing up fee, renaming him in the process. My mother said after my discharge that the reason the officer put my name down as John Wilson was that he could draw my bounty. This concept of naming and the importance and value in a name is carried through in the following stanzas. The slave was traditionally given the surname of their owner as opposed to their family name. So this process of reclaiming their names, their ancestry, is powerful and poignant. I am the son of Solomon and Lucinda Sibley. The repetition and anaphora throughout the poem, particularly the I am, builds to a powerful crescendo and is the most important technique in the poem. Be sure to mention it in your answer. The last stanza of the excerpt is a final voice of reclamation. My correct name is Hiram Kirkland. Some persons call me Harry and others call me Henry, but neither is my correct name. The poem is setting straight the record. Long after these voices had been dismissed and silenced in their quest for justice and equality. Yet, never is the tone of the collective voices bitter or accusatory. The poem is a harsh critique of the legacy of slavery and its forgotten voices, a reminder in our modern world to listen to marginalised voices. So, to recap, themes: historical retribution, slavery, racism, the importance of naming. Key images: the contrast of the old men versus their youth when they enlisted. Stylistic features: the direct voices of the black veterans, the dash, the collective voice, repetition. Tone: dignified, persistent, poignant. The greatest personal privation. This poem is very similar to, and can be read in conjunction with, from I Will Tell You the Truth About This, I Will Tell You All About It. It takes historical records, in this case, letters between the Jones family, slave owners in the 19th century, and reappropriates their voices, giving their words to their slaves. The Jones are in the process of selling an entire family of slaves, and this forms the narrative thread of the poem, which is in 5 sections. Each section could be a different voice. As with a lot of Smith's poetry, she gives voices to those who have been silenced in history. The themes are the horrors of slavery and its legacy. But the poem also hails the dignity with which many slaves bore their incarceration. Section 1 opens with, "It is a painful and harassing business belonging to her." The verb belonging jolts the reader into the context of slavery, and the adjectives painful and harassing evoke empathy. The slaves have no comfort or confidence in the slave owners, showing the harsh and precarious nature of slavery. The utter inhumanity of "they could dispose of the whole family without consulting us" is brutal. The word "trouble" is repeated, but in reference to the slave owners and not the slaves. The owners are the source of the trouble and the reason they appear unhappy themselves. The astonishing benevolence of the final line of this section is most impactful. "I have prayed for those people many, many, very many times." Despite unfathomable oppression, the speaker prays for his or her captors. Section 2 is a much darker passage. The speaker appears to be wishing for death, and wish no more to be, only waiting to be sent home in peace with God. There is resignation and despair here that is only marginally ameliorated by the thought of peace with God. The thoughts of missing her mother do not deter these suicidal thoughts. I find the third section to be the most moving. It is a damning indictment of the legacy of slavery, how "we may yet discover the whole country will not come back from the sale of parent and child." This voice from the past predicts the trauma to be far-reaching and, in a sense, irreparable. This is true today. America is still ravaged by this historical legacy. The enjambment and separation of the words "parent" and "child" on the page evoke this separation and suffering. Typically, slaves were cast as inferior beings with moral weaknesses, in an attempt to justify their appalling treatment, but the speaker poignantly attempts to reject the blame for their oppression. But we cannot be all the cause of all that has been done. Section 4 hints at rebellion and the hope of action. We wish to act, we may yet. The short, snappy sentences creating tension, the pronoun we evoking collective power. The final section is startling for its form. Varying voices are cut off mid-plea using the dash. It is confronting and creates a staccato breathlessness when read aloud. Please, we cannot. Please, we have got to. Please, the children. Mother and father and husband and all of you. All, I have no more. The eviscerating final lines echo this cutting off of families. How soon and unexpectedly cut off. Many, many, very many times. The sheer number of families affected captured in this aching repetition. What a moving poem. So, to recap. Themes. The legacy and trauma of slavery. Reclaiming voice and agency. Key images. The separation of families. The girl wishing for death and peace. Stylistic features. The direct voices of the slaves appropriating the words of the slave owners. The dash. The collective voice. Repetition. Tone. Moving. Devastating. Recrimination. Don't you wonder sometimes? Don't you wonder sometimes, as the title suggests, is a poem that wanders through flights of fancy. And as with all internal wanderings of the human mind, it can be challenging for students to find a unifying narrative thread in the poem. Smith was inspired by both space and the creativity of the artist David Bowie, and he features as a character in this poem, which is in three sections. Let's condense each section now to its most important thematic concerns and images. Section 1 deals with the vastness of space. Stars glisten like ice. And the idea that a godlike figure, a Bowie being, a starman, exists out there. He appears to be saying, nothing is lost, that everything lives on, waiting only to be wanted back badly enough. Hinting that the linear quality of time appears to be lost. And the speaker can return at will to her childhood. Will I put on my coat and return to the kitchen where my mother and father sit waiting, dinner keeping warm on the stove? There is comfort throughout this stanza, this imagined time travelling bringing us back to people and places we love through the suspension of traditional notions of temporality. Space offers a sense of immortality here. He'll never grow old. The second section develops Bowie as this elusive character. He leaves no tracks. Smith and Bowie both lived in New York at the same time. And while the rest of the city appears to suffer in the New York heat, we sweat it out. Bowie avoids the worst, but not for Bowie. He has a wicked grin, suggesting a mischievous man. This section is punctuated by Smith's trademark rhetorical questions. Time never stops, but does it end? Existential questions with no answers and ambiguous statements, the future isn't what it used to be, provokes the reader to do what the title suggests, to wonder. The section ends with a vivid simile. Jets blink across the sky like migratory souls. The beautiful image brings us back to the imagery of space as somewhere for souls to live on, from section 1. The final section opens with a tongue-in-cheek play on the biblical idea that God is among us. Bowie is among us. This idolatry continues throughout the stanza, at times bordering the absurd, in my opinion, but the tone here is playful, and overall the poem is not to be taken too seriously. While the stanza praises Bowie, Bowie, I want to believe you, want to feel your will like the wind before the rain. The power of this stanza lies in its imagery. The poet imagines he burns bright, dragging a tail of white-hot matter the way some of us track tissue back from a toilet stall. The conflation of the extraterrestrial and the ordinary entertain and amuse the reader here. She imagines someone communicating telepathically with Bowie. Send a thought like shine, 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 straight to your mind. Finally, she imagines Bowie with a godlike power. The poem has some lovely imagery. For the essay, focus on the character of Bowie and her questions and musings about space and time. So, to recap. Themes. The universe, time and space, temporality. Key images. David Bowie, his elusive nature, his godlike caricature in the poem, the matter like toilet paper. Stylistic features. Rhetorical questions. The use of David Bowie. Tone, wonder, humorous, entertaining, irreverent. Conclusion. So that's all the poems on the Leaving Cert course. Smith's poetry is vibrant. She explores both current and historical themes. Her poetry can be deeply personal and fiercely political. She is a fantastic poet to focus on for the exam. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast and the very best of luck.
And that concludes our podcast on Tracy K. Smith. For more in-depth analysis on the poets you're studying for the Leaving Cert, be sure to check out all the other podcasts on the StudyClicks Explains network. If you enjoyed this podcast or found it helpful, please share it with a friend. And lastly, turn on notifications wherever you're listening so you're the first to know when a new episode drops. Bye for now, and best of luck in your exams.